Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery, code Wondery.
Have you ever covered a carpet stain with a rug? Ignored a leaky faucet? Pretended your half-painted living room is supposed to look like that? Well, you're not alone. We've all got unfinished home projects. But there's an easier way. When you download Thumbtack, it's easier to care for your home from top to bottom. Pull out your phone and in just a few steps, you can search, chat, and book highly rated pros right in your neighborhood. Plus, you'll know what to tackle next, because Thumbtack is the app that shows you what to do, who to hire, and when. So say goodbye to all those unfinished home projects and say hello to caring for your home the easier way. Download Thumbtack and start a project today.
Welcome to the Nerds Podcast number 399. There's a lot of exciting things happening in the Nerdist Industries ecosystem. Would you say that, Matthew?
No.
Why?
It's not really an ecosystem. It doesn't really support any life.
It does support life. How many people do we employ? It absolutely supports life.
Oh, I guess
life.
In that sense.
Yeah. It supports your life. What do you talk? It supports my life. It supports Katie and Kyle. Welcome to a very special intro of the Nerds Podcast with Matt and Myra.
Yeah, well, I just thought ecosystem. I don't know. Think of another word. The Nerdist biosphere.
Nerdist biosphere.
I'll go with that.
With
the self-contained thing.
With Stephen Baldwin and Pauly Shore?
That's a biodome.
Oh, okay.
I want a full sphere.
I've been to the biosphere in Arizona, and it's awesome.
Did you have to, scrub up before you went in kind of thing, not to taint it?
No, it's already way tainted. It's full of taints because it's not a working biosphere anymore. It's just, this is what it was like when people tried to live here.
So it's like America will be in 100 years.
Welcome to our introstful.
Abandoned biosphere?
What if I did went to an abandoned biosphere? We had to figure out who was pretending to haunt the local hotel, and it was Old Man Carruthers from the keeper of the biosphere. It was Scatman Carruthers. All right. I guess we could just title this intro Off the Rails. I would like to...
The Rails is my favorite ride at that haunted amusement park.
God damn it, stop being funny. Then people are going to want you in every intro, and I can't schedule that. There are a lot of other amazing podcasts that you should check out within the Nerds Network. As a matter of fact, Matt Myra is starting James Bonding.
James Bonding with Matt and Matt. Matt Gourley and myself break down every James Bond movie in a row.
So is it a limited run?
Well, yeah, I don't know what we're going to do after that. I kind of like the finite number situation.
Okay.
It's not like we'll get to Nerdist number 399.
Right.
And go,
which is this one.
Fuck.
Well done.
Will this stop?
Good. Okay, good way to promote your new podcast and then shit on your current one.
Listen to it. It'll stop.
Oh, I know. But there are a ton of other podcasts that you should listen to as well. Chewing It with Kevin Heffernan and Steve Lemming from Broken Lizard. Competitive erotic fanfiction, which I saw a chunk of the other night, which is hilarious. Comics come in and then they basically have to go write erotic fanfiction and they come and present it for the crowd. And then also The Mutant Season with 11-year-old Gil, whose dad owns Meltdown and who is one of the sweetest, smartest, most articulate 11-year-olds. I'm just going to say people in general. He's about to have his 100th episode, so check out The Mutant Season with Gil.
I think it jumped the shark when I was on it.
Did you?
I did one, yeah. We talked about space.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it was great.
I got to pop in, too.
Space and James Bond.
So that one, JV Club with Janet Varney, Writer's Panel with Ben Blacker. So
Four Eyes and Beard
Four
with
Eyes
Scott
and Beard.
Mosier and Matt Myra.
Yeah. You have a lot of podcasts. So check those out. You can go to Nerdist.com and then click on the podcast link and subscribe. We have tons. One to suit almost all of your needs. Also, Alton Brown Cast. Alton Brown. That's a new one that's been doing really well, too. So thanks to those guys. Thanks to all of you for supporting all our podcasts. And thanks to Katie, who produces the shit out of most of those. As we go into this episode, which is Bill Hader, which just recorded a couple days ago. Bill is promoting Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs 2, which is in theater September 27th. Also, he's up for an Emmy for Outstanding Supporting Actor in a Comedy Series on SNL. We never really hung out with Bill before. And he was, I say this a lot. Maybe people are trying to hear of it. But he was great.
Yeah.
We get lucky with a lot of pretty great guests. And Bill,
and if we ever get unlucky, you'll never hear it.
No, we have to. We have to put it out. My time is too precious now. Like, I can't spend an hour doing something and be like, I can't put it out now. Besides, I think people, if we do have train wrecky ones, people are going to want to hear those too.
Yeah, sure.
So
I'll do my best to make everyone a train wreck.
This was not, well, you did a good job with this intro. This, here we go. Here we go with the nerd. I think you did a really nice job in the intro. It was
Thanks.
Nice having you
I
sit
thought
in the intro.
It would be nice for me to say hi to everybody up top.
Introstful.
And also, it's a good way for me to learn what's going on, because I've never listened to a podcast.
This is where you get your Nerdist news from.
Thanks.
Also, check out Nerdist News Nerdist.
And while you're at it, subscribe to the YouTube channel.
YouTube. Why not? Seriously, do it. Send me $1 billion. Would you just send me $1 billion? That's really what this is about, isn't it?
I mean, there's a couple hundred thousand of you probably listening to this episode right now.
If each of you sent us $100,000,
would it kill you to just click subscribe on the YouTube page? That's all I'm asking.
One person's going to die doing it, and then they're going to say, yes, Matt, it did kill that person.
Well, I'm sorry if that was your time.
All right. Matt has a very healthy relationship to death.
I do.
But we're going
to pick out a casket later.
We're going to celebrate life with the Nerdist Podcast number 399 with Bill Hader.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Yeah, how are you? Are you the skinniest guy in the room?
I don't know. Guys.
Do you go work out?
Guys,
do you work
out?
He doesn't drink.
That's true.
Oh, yeah?
That's always added
stuff.
Oh,
yeah?
Yeah.
And do you like sweets?
I don't love them.
Okay.
So yeah, like I don't love them.
Really?
Yeah, I don't really like sweets.
What about the time you got mad at the lady in the Portland coffee shop?
That wasn't a sweet. That was a savory.
That was
a savory.
I came from Los Angeles.
That was a savory.
I didn't say it that way.
What did he want?
I am so mad.
I can't remember. It was like a
I know exactly what he wanted.
Don't say it like that.
He wanted a ham and cheese croissant at this particular place in Portland.
Okay, it is one of my favorite food items in the entire country is at this one bakery.
His defense to, I'm sorry, we're all out.
No.
Yeah, excuse me. I'll tell the story.
Your Honor.
Excuse me.
Conjecture?
Here we go. His defense to, I'm sorry, we're all out, was to get particularly whiny and then express that he had come up from Los Angeles just for this
croissant. I just said that out loud. We had traveled. I hadn't slept. I'll tell you exactly what
I'm
it was.
I'm so mad they found another one for you.
Have you ever...
It worked.
Odd that they found one.
Yeah. Have you ever been in one of those situations where... you get bummed about something really stupid, but then the person, not that they should, but there's just that moment where they're like, what do you want me to do about it? And then you just feel like, oh, come on, just be a little like, oh, come earlier tomorrow.
I don't know if there's any way out of this.
No, yeah, I think you're going to.
Own up that you were a jerk.
Yeah.
But I get it.
Bill Hader's right.
As I text.
Yeah. Like I said, completely checked out from the get-go.
I was a total jerk that day. I really was a jerk that day.
No, but you got it.
But we hadn't really slept that much, and that was the day that we traveled up to Portland.
Yeah, that long trip up to Portland.
God, what is it? Almost 3 hours.
Hey guys, who else works 15-hour days here? Not the
Whoa,
two of you.
Oh,
huh?
Burn.
You don't know that. You really don't know what I do when I'm not here.
You also, I mean, I work enough.
I was thinking of all kinds of great Ray Donovan tweets all day. I got up early for it.
Are you watching Ray Donovan? He's obsessed with
I haven't seen Ray Donovan yet.
You got to watch it.
Really?
He doesn't
That's
use
a ringing endorsement.
I feel like you can...
Oh, you've got to watch
I feel like you hate love
You can hear
or
in his
do you
voice.
Love
no, I don't know yet.
You can hear
I can't stop watching
He's
it.
Not lying, but he doesn't believe himself when he says it.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I have no idea. Like, I was telling Matt the other day, I was like, I don't know if it's like I like it as a show or a reference point.
Right.
I can't tell.
Yeah. But but you're so passionate about it in a way that makes me feel like, you have to see how awful this is.
No, it's not that.
Oh, is it off? Is it bad?
No, parts of it. Like, every once in a while, there's just something that's bad that you laugh at, and it's usually involving, like, the wife or, like, some situations. But other than that, like, there's all this great acting and great situations.
Yeah, it's a really good cast.
Yeah.
Liev Schreiber is pretty awesome.
Yeah,
he's pretty great.
Good.
But he's not the best one in the show.
Who is the best one in the show?
The guy who plays his brother with Parkinson's, who's like a British actor that really has the best Boston accent out of all of them.
Wow. Yeah. That's how it always is. Yeah. All those British actors. That's like that new the show after Breaking Bad now. It's like
Low Winter Sun.
They're all British actors.
They're all Brits, yeah.
They're all Brits.
Really?
Yeah.
Jesus.
The guy from Walking Dead's British. I didn't realize that until I watched the interview
with him.
Yeah.
Everyone on Downton Abbey is...
They're all from Brooklyn.
All the people in Downton Abbey are from Brooklyn.
This is how they're infiltrating us. You know, after the revolution, this is after we overthrew the king. This is how they're slowly coming back and infiltrating.
Hundreds of years from now, we will take over their acting troops.
Wait a minute. Tim Berners-Lee invented the internet so they could slowly infiltrate our entertainment business.
I've got an idea, chaps.
Finally, after all these years.
We wait for the television to be invented.
This is what we have to do, friend.
Oh, you were waiting for this. Sorry.
Is this the show?
Yeah, it's the show.
Oh, good.
Yeah. We're changing the name to Ordering Chipotle.
Yeah.
Ordering Chipotle.
As they're looking at the last results of the Revolutionary War, where they're deciding we have to surrender and get out of this colony, that's when they're deciding to infiltrate television.
They're looking at the results, like, in the sports page, the war section of the newspaper.
Yeah.
You got the war section.
Nice, black.
Here, take that.
Oh, thank you, Chris.
The Daily
Mail. Here. 20, 40.
Chris, could you just do me a favor and make it rain?
Orders.
All right.
You gave it a thought.
I did give it a thought for a second. No, Bill, we got it. We're good. Yeah, fine.
Thank you.
You're a guest in our house, Bill.
What's that weird show that Paul F. has been posting about? Gorberger? No, that's the TJ thing.
Gorberger's great.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Gorberger, I don't even know what that is.
It's this weird, like, monster. It's a web show where the TJ Miller plays the voice of some crazy, huge monster.
Oh, wow.
It's like a talk show.
Japanese talk show.
That's funny.
But then it has, like, great bands on it, like Flaming Lips and the
Dumb Paul F's been posting. I saw him post to the Instagram of the Boardwalk Empire screenshots.
Yeah, but there's some show. It's like it's a Danish show that they're showing. I saw a bus ad for it.
Oh, it's not The Bridge, is it?
No. That's not The Bridge. It's Gorburn. I don't know what it is. Doesn't matter.
Borgen. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm just now got into, because I haven't watched The Killing on AMC. I decided to watch the Danish. Like, I went and got like a all region player.
Yeah.
And then had them send it to me. But I got that, The Bridge, and Borgen.
Nice. The Bridge, the original version?
Yeah.
Yeah, for Christmas, Kumail and Emily gave D and I an all region player and the Bridge and the original Bridge and the original Killing.
Yeah.
And
the Killing's good.
Yeah, we watched The Bridge and just were obsessed with it.
Yeah.
But don't you watch The Killing as an actor and go, how the fuck do they not want to kill themselves after every? Because everyone's just, you know, this is the one character.
They're talking about the Danish. I haven't seen the American, but you're just saying in general.
In general, in the American version,
it's pretty rough.
Everyone's just crying all the time.
The Danish one is, I mean, kind of par for the course for just, you know, Norwegian theater. I mean, all the, you know. Bergman movies and stuff, you just want to blow your brains. You know, every Bergman movie you watch, you're like, they're all beautiful and they want to kill themselves.
It's winter all the time.
Yeah, it's winter all the time and there is no God.
Even the movie Clown. That's after watching that.
Clown still, you just like that the three-way scene in that. Yeah,
you want to
kill yourself.
Have you seen Clown?
No.
It's pretty funny.
It's on Netflix.
It's pretty funny.
Yeah, it's really funny. I guess those two guys had a show, right?
Yeah.
And then this is their movie version of it, but it's you can look up a scene online where it's the two of them negotiating a three-way
with this really large woman.
Yeah, and it's a way for them to figure out a way just so they can crash there for the night.
Yeah, the only way they can sleep there is if they fuck this woman. Yeah. Like both of them together. And very funny. I was watching that and we had just gotten a new babysitter and she happened to walk in to our little living room right when I was playing and I was like, oh, hey, hold on real quick. Hi, I'm Bill.
Did you feel like
you're watching my kid?
Do you feel like there's any part of you that goes that in your head goes, is there any way that she would be able to sue me because she thinks I'm trying to show...
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, this is just what we watch around here.
Yeah. No, 100%. I after that happened, everything that I watched, no matter... Because it was always at night, and she was there at night. I would always say, hey, just so you know... I'm watching this movie called Kill List. It's supposed to be pretty fucked up. So if you come in and you see some messed up stuff, I'm watching the movie for the first time. This is all, you know, please don't freak out.
I'm watching a movie called Romper Stomper. Now, when you watch it,
it's a little
celebrating.
Have you seen American History X? Okay, when you see it.
Like, pretty cool, right? Like, those guys all have the right idea, right? Okay.
No, I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding.
Okay, by the look in your face, I'm joking now. I'm backtracking now.
Why are you crying? Stop crying! Do you live in Los Angeles now?
Yeah, I just moved here.
Welcome nice. Back.
Welcome.
Thanks. Yes.
Yes.
Nice being back.
Joking. Yes.
Does it when you the like the couple months or the maybe the week or two after you leave SNL, do you still have that sort of crushing like, hey, I have a deadline? Oh, I'm okay.
Oh yeah.
I'm okay.
I still have SNL nightmares at right around this time in August is when you start having your SNL nightmares because the show's like a month away and. Usually it deals with, like, not knowing your, like, not having the cue cards ready or you're in the costume for the wrong sketch. I mean, it's all very cliched things, but it's true. You do have those. And then that happened to me last season where
what?
The Melissa McCarthy show, she did this sketch where she was a basketball coach and it was very funny. And I had the cue card. Well, one, they didn't have my cue cards at the top of the sketch, which was terrifying.
What do you do?
I just was like. You know, it was like a quick tease before we went to videotape.
Oh, okay.
So it was like two sentences, and I was like, I just approximated those. And it was fine. And then I got on my, you know, mark, and me and Melissa have a scene together, and all of her cue cards, which are behind me, were all the rewrites, and all of her cue cards behind her were everything from dress rehearsal.
Oh, shit.
So
no.
I'm saying things, and she doesn't have a response on her cue cards because those beats were cut. So I asked her a question, not knowing that those beats were cut. And if you watch it, there's like a little pause where she's like, that's not on my cue card. So it was just kind of this back and forth kind of a dance of getting around this giant mistake that
happened. I guess if there's anyone that you would want to be in that situation with, it would probably be
Melissa. 100%. She's an amazing improviser and just quick on her feet. If it was Michael Phelps or something, it would have been like,
hey, that's all wrong. Hey,
throw that big paper over there.
Bring him closer.
Hey, wait a minute. That's not what we're supposed to say.
Yeah, that would have been bad.
Hold on, I got this. Just takes off his shirt.
The crowd goes crazy, and I'm like, that's the sketch. I just look at the camera. End of sketch.
Oh, my God, you guys. Maybe they're going to do the taking off the shirt sketch this week.
Yeah,
I'm
please.
Like, oh, no, that's a...
I need another Michael Phelps taking his shirt off this week.
No, that was just a mistake. Was it?
It wasn't really. No.
I would imagine that when people come on the show, when guest hosts come on the show, everyone's pretty... Because I'm sure people are nervous. So is everyone pretty cool? Or?
I would say almost 100% of the time, people are incredibly, this is your house. I'm a guest here. How can I, you know, I just, you know, they roll with it a little bit, you know. But it's tough. I mean, you know, you might have an idea and you're really excited about it. And then you put it up, you know, host might have an idea and they just see like it doesn't really play. And it's just. It's, you know, you can't, and outside of SNL, that idea could be very, very funny. It just needs to work on that show. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like, it's a thing, I've said this a lot, but Steve Higgins told me, it's like the Venn diagram of what the show finds funny and what you find funny. It's like, there needs to be some crossover there, you know, for your thing to work. So the people who tend to come in and who really are great are the people who are very open and who get the show's sensibility, you know what I mean?
Yeah, well, because I always think that there's probably there are basically two audiences that you're playing for on that show. It's like a theater show, but then the television part of it makes it sort of weird because you can't stuff that you could get away with in theater doesn't necessarily work on television and vice versa because you're in close-ups,
totally.
But then you still have to play big for the audience.
Yeah,
there.
You have to perform instead of act, as they say. You know what I mean? And it's performing big. That's why Justin Timberlake, I think, is so good at the show because he's like –
Mickey Mouse Club trained.
He just knows
how to hit his mark and like play out and do his thing no matter what it is. And it always works. It's like people just are you don't have to tell him what to do. He just knows how to play it, you know.
And that's a good point too, even like his acting in a movie I saw of him where he is a bit bigger than everybody else only because of his background and what he's used to.
Yeah. Also it's acting versus performing thing, which is it's really difficult to kind of work on, but that was what was so nice about doing those digital shorts of us having so many pre-tape pieces at my time there was that you could kind of act a little smaller, you know what I mean? You could act instead of perform, you know?
Now, when you when you left, was it like, okay, it's time, I just want to kind of move on and do a new, you know, like pursue some other stuff?
It was more of like, just I want to go, live in Los Angeles because my wife, who's a director, was constantly coming out here. I was constantly coming out here, and we have two kids, and we were all on top of each other. it was pretty gross. Ew,
kids.
Boo.
Wait, your wife is
Maggie Carey.
Yeah, I remember Maggie.
Yeah,
and so she's the one that wrote and directed
The To Do List.
That's crazy.
Yeah, that's her movie.
Because I remember her, she like talking about like wanting to write more, like back before you guys moved.
No, and she did this web series called The Jeannie Tate Show with Liz Kukowski.
Oh, it was the one in the van, right?
Yeah, the one in the van. And so then she made this movie. And so we're just out here all the time. So we just wanted to have space. And so that really is where it came from, which was, it's my last season, my contract's up. And then us talking over Christmas and going, well, what do we want to do? And then once it was decided we were going to move, I went in and talked to Lauren and said, yeah, I'm moving to L.A. And he was like, he just went, like, he made his face. Like.
Did he, like, do that to his foot?
Yeah. And he went, no, but he was understanding. He was actually, you know, it was a combination of, I totally understand you have kids. I totally get that. And it's hard to do the show with two kids. And I think you're making a giant mistake.
Oh, shit. I totally get it. You're fucking me.
No, but it was like, you should stick around, but I fully understand. You know what I mean? Like, I would love if you stick around, but I totally get it.
How much longer would you have had to stick around? Would you have had to re-up a contract?
Yeah, probably. I don't know how that works. If it's like then another season. I don't know how that works.
I like that you moved to L.A. for space.
Yeah,
New York's
no.
the only place you can come from where L.A.
Oh,
is spacious.
Yeah.
Well, it's also...
No, it's true, though. It's...
When you're a young performer, though, and you kind of think, oh, my God, if I could just get on SNL or if I could just get one job, then everything would be set. And then you flash forward when you start to get older, and especially if you have kids, or, like, you really do start taking into consideration, like, but how do I want to live? Like, how do I actually want to enjoy my life? And then you go, wow, I can't believe, you know, I guess it's a sign of maturity that you can make those kinds of decisions and go, the career stuff will be fine.
No, it is true. I mean, you worry about the career stuff, obviously, you know, all the time, but it is kind of like, you know, it's really hard on doing that show is incredibly taxing. And then to do anything outside of the show, which I always try to do, is incredibly taxing on top of that. And then you have a family and you have all, you know what I mean?
How did that like work when you're just swamped at work and then you come home and then you also like you have to be just
a dad
mentally available?
Yeah,
to your
it's
family.
Hard. It is hard. You know, I mean, during show weeks, I might as well have just been out of town.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Because, during the season, it's this thing happens where during the season, I'm kind of just, I'm never 100% there. Yeah. And that's what, you know, in the summer around this time, I start to just become more, it takes like another month and a half to kind of come down from it. Ugh. And then you have a month and a half where you feel available, and then it all starts to ramp up again, you know, for 9 months.
How did that, like, how was the strain on the relationship with Maggie? Like, did that, like, were there times where just like, hey, you need to just kind of be here when you're here?
Yeah, no, Maggie is actually incredibly, understanding, and B, she's very, you know, kind of, I was gonna, you know, independent, or, you know what I mean? Like, she's just very much, she gets it, you know, and that's what's great about being married to someone who is also in this industry is she's like, no, I get it, you know. When she was making her movie, you know, she's like, I'm not that available, you know.
Yeah.
But it was stuff like during show weeks, every Thursday night was we would go on a date. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Even if it wasn't going out, it would be like
watching a movie or
yeah, let's watch a movie or have dinner or okay, let's catch up on Walking Dead or whatever it is, yeah, yeah. You know, and just kind of be, you know,
yeah.
A couple.
Yeah. You got to do that. Yeah, you got to find that time. You got to force it in.
Yeah, totally.
Well, it's important because, you know, you sort of take for granted that a new relationship, like a year under relationship, everything's very effortless because it's like, we're just being around each other all the time. And then you start to get a little comfortable and then you know, it's like, okay, well, I got to focus on work and I got to focus. And then sometimes you're like, why isn't this as easy as it was? And we're like, no, because it's like anything else. You have to nurture it. You can't just like pot a flower and 100%. Go, that's good forever. Yeah. Like, no, it's you got to take care of it.
I think you can.
Good luck
depending
with
that. On the flower.
Good luck with that.
Depending on the flower. Yeah, I mean, you do have to like, and I will say my first season on the show, I was so completely flipped out and because I thought they were going to figure out that they made a huge mistake. And I was going like, I got this way too early. And I don't know, I'm out of my league here. And I don't know what's going on. So that I was, you know, a little bit more manic. And when I was at home, I was like, hey, you know what I mean? Yeah. I was just kind of freaking out. Just go to a room and close the door and be like, hi, I got to go. You know,
and then just sit and think.
Yeah, and just sit there and kind of stew. But even then, she, you know, Maggie was super understanding with every show and, you know, was like, you know, how are you feeling? Is everything all right?
But as she's also a creative type, too, and she goes through the same kind of
shit. Yeah, she fully understood it.
Were you there? Like, is it kind of like, that's what I realized with my wife, where it's like, you know, when she's working on stuff or projects, it's like, you know, she has those same creative person breakdowns and
totally.
Like, it's like, you know, you and then you have to be like, oh, it's gonna be okay, you're great, but then you can just almost instantly go, but I'm feeling real bad about my have to turn around.
It's so bad when you both have the same kinds of insecurities and they activate each other.
You can't have that. I mean, the thing I'm learning too is, and this kind of just goes in general, is when someone's giving you notes on something or you give someone notes, it's always best to just say what you feel isn't working, not to say how you'd fix it.
Yes.
You know what I mean? When you say, here's what's not working, or here, you know, you're usually right. But when you say, and then I would do this to fix it, you're always wrong. Do you know what I mean?
And that
turns into tension where I was like, why don't you just do this?
Yeah.
You know, or I'll, you know, be freaking out because there was a long time where I was very self-conscious that I couldn't get a character on the show. I had a hard time. I did impressions, but I could never get a character on the show. And Maggie would say, why don't you just, you know, do, you know, what the shows that you watch and like, why don't you do someone on one of those shows, right? Like so and so, and I'd be like, "What? Why would I ever do that person?" You know.
and so the first part was great advice,
and then vice versa, where I'd say, "You know, I think the movie this part doesn't, you know, work or whatever. Why don't you not have Aubrey Plaza say this or whatever?" And she just, you know, could you just get out?
Yeah,
you know,
what happened recently with Dee and I, where she's working on that short at Nickelodeon, and like they gave her some notes. I was like, I totally know what they're saying. This is what you should do. And like, I like everything. And she took it back in and she's like, I was like, what'd they say? And she's like, oh, they said those notes were completely wrong.
Yeah.
And I should put it back to the way I had it. And I go, oh, well, I'm sorry. I almost fucking blew that for you.
Yeah, no, because you don't know where everyone's coming from. It's that thing of like, they're not wrong. No one's wrong. It's just everyone's has a different, just sees it differently.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just trying to get everybody to see the same thing. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it wasn't until, that I saw Maggie's movie that I went, oh, that was the tone of it. I was going this other place.
Oh,
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And you kind of go, oh, I see. Yeah, you're right. 100%. You know, not the acting. I understood the acting and the general tone. But once I saw it all cut together with music and everything, I went, oh, okay. My bad.
Well, there's a real danger. And I mean, I think particularly something like SNL can really train you to be super nimble. But I feel like it probably, and I feel like we probably all have a very similar issue, is you're constantly in putting out fire mode.
Yeah.
And so, but not every interpersonal relationship calls for putting out fire mode all the time.
Yeah.
So, no, Matt. So,
watch that flower.
So it really, it can really sort of work against you in that way where you're like, no, just fix this thing. You're like, no, I don't, you don't have to do, you don't have to do that.
Yeah.
You could just listen.
Yeah.
And then that would be enough.
That's it. Just listen.
Yeah, just listen to what's going on. And I always, and I did this constantly where I would say, oh, maybe this is what's wrong with it. And I go, oh, no, that's, it's kind of my response, you know, the last question, or last time we talked, last question, blah, blah, blah. Last question was, you know, you're just saying, well, this is what I would do. You know what I mean? You know, Keenan, I would just do this. You know, and he's going, well, you can't sing or dance or do, you know what I mean? I can sing and dance, so I'm going to go do this. And you're like, you're right. You know, but to what you're saying, that happens at SNL constantly where you just can hone something down and hone it down. And I remember the last Stefan sketch we did, it was at a wedding to Anderson Cooper thing, and I was sitting, we were sitting there talking about it, and then somebody said, well, do you want little chyrons that says, because it was him in the wedding, and he saw everybody that Stefan had mentioned was in the wedding, and it was like, well, and then you know, we should have little chyrons or something kind of saying like Jewish vampire, but you know, so because people aren't going to know who they are, and you know, we want to make sure that you know, people kind of, you know, you get exhausted and you get freaked out. And I remember Seth Meyers going, no, don't solve the crossword puzzle for people, you know, just let it be. And, you know, and you just need that. Like Seth is really good at giving those notes and he's very quick at saying, here's why I don't think that works for this show, blah, 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 blah. But you know, you're on the right direction. You're in the right direction. You know what I mean? Or I think it's kind of low energy. Or it's kind of like something someone else did, you know, and that's all you have to say. And you go, right. Okay. Thanks. You know, he was very good at that. There was never sitting you down saying, here's why I feel like this doesn't work. You know, that never,
especially in that, situation, all you have to do is just solve the thing as fast as possible. Like you don't have to really. It almost feels kind of shitty if people got really heavy and emotional about it. No, we're just in it. This just has to be streamlined.
You just don't have the time for it, you know? It's the same thing at South Park, too. You know, those guys just, they don't have the time to go, well, you know, it's just like, you know? It's very friendly, you know? That's the other thing I realized, too, is that if you're a new writer and you're going to a writer's room, the worst thing you could do, even if you feel this way, is like finding this balance. You can't say, if you don't like something, you shouldn't go, that's great. Some people do that because they're just nervous and they want to keep the energy in the room. Like, oh, that's funny, you know. But at the same time, it's the opposite. It's true. Like, you just go, nah, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It just kills the vibe in the room. There's one writer on the show, I won't say who it is, but you would say, I was thinking about maybe an idea where... you know, we would do the, you know, I remember one time, what was the freaking idea? I had a bad idea for Taylor Swift where I was like something where she's like a government agent or something because just her attitude, like no one can get mad at her. And like, I'm trying to figure it out. I'm like, this is lame. But it's like, you know, it's like she's a, like some sort of weapon that they use. You know, and I'm trying to explain it to this writer, and he's like, right. He goes, I love that. What if she is the tooth fairy? And you're like, okay, so you don't like it.
You don't like it.
Just say you don't like it.
Yeah. So it's the opposite.
So you don't like it. You want to do your idea, the tooth fairy idea. You know what I mean? So it is hard.
Well, I guess also because there's that thing with a lot of, with most comics where they just don't want, they just want people to like them, you know, like they don't want to, I mean, I guess I'm probably one of those people where you just don't want to hurt anyone's, you just want everyone to feel okay and supported.
Yeah. And also it's nerve wracking when you're working with people. I'm sure the writer's standpoint is like, I'm, you know, on SNL at least, like I'm working for this, you know, performer and I want to make them, you know, want to work with me. And then as a performer, I'm looking at the writer going, I want you to write for me. Yeah. You know what I mean? So it's this awkward conversation of like, I don't know, you know.
It's a two people too polite to go through the door. You're both just saying,
No, you go.
No.
Well, that's funny. Yeah, no. Yeah, maybe, Yeah, huh, you know.
Shit, we didn't write anything.
Yeah, we didn't do anything because it stunk. I'm that way just in general. If I meet somebody who I really like, I will, or I'm in awe of and I want them to like me, I find myself saying things that I've never said before in my life, like a word. Like the first time I met Bill Murray, Jim Downey, who's a writer on the show, called me. He's like, Bill Murray. He's like, come down to this, you know, bar. I'm watching a baseball game. And I went down there, and it was Bill Murray and him in this back room.
Jesus.
And it was just the three of us. And I'm sitting there going like, oh, my God. You know. And help me out, guys. Who's the actor from Cool Hand Luke who says, you know, what we got here is failure to communicate. Strother Martin.
Yeah.
So he was a huge fan of Strother Martin. And Bill Murray was talking about it, and he goes, oh, I convinced Lorne to have Strother Martin host SNL. And he's telling me this cool story, and I go, oh, and did he have chops?
You mean acting like comedy chops?
Yeah. And he goes, oh, yeah, he had chops. And then we left, and Maggie was with me, and Maggie goes, did he have chops? Like, well, I wanted Bill Murray to like me so much. I don't know. It seemed like a word he would use. Like, did he have chops? I don't know. He's like, did he have chops?
Well, I think when you're in that situation, particularly, and you're faced with someone like that, and you're trying to impress him, basically, your brain is scanning everything you've ever experienced in your entire life, and just trying to, it's like, just trying to make a match until you focus on one thing.
Yeah.
But you don't really have that much control over where it's going to focus. So it's just like, brrr, chops.
Chops. Yeah. And you go, did you have chops?
Well, at least it didn't make him go, what are you talking about?
No, he went, no, he did. Mm-hmm. He went like that.
Chops, yeah, it's funny.
Chops,
yeah.
He was like, yeah, yes, he did have chops.
Well, I think Bill Murray admired my chops for using the chops reference.
Very, very well. But it was clearly the way the word came out of my mouth. I've never used it in a sentence before. But did he have chops?
It would almost be fun to strap a GoPro camera to Bill Murray and just send him around and watch people react to him.
Yeah.
Because a guy like that has, like, that just happens to him all the time. Yeah. Where people are just like, ah.
At the Comedy Awards, I don't think you'll mind me saying this, at the Comedy Awards, okay, so like Trey Parker and Matt Stone, like, don't get, you know, starstruck by anybody, really. They're kind of like, oh, wow, there's so-and-so. You know what I mean?
No, we made fun of that guy.
We made fun of that guy. When Trey, at the first Comedy Central Comedy Awards, when Trey met Bill Murray, he started crying. He just started crying. He's like, you're like the reason I'm doing what I'm doing. Like, I can't believe I'm here. Can I get a picture with you? And his wife took a picture with him, and Trey was just like, the picture's hilarious. Trey looks like a 15-year-old. Just like, and Bill Murray's like, yeah, I like the show, man. It's great. He's like, you seen the show? Oh, wow, cool. He goes, we have a show on Broadway right now called Book of Mormon. He's like, yeah, no, I heard it was good. You know, and he was like, yeah, you should see it, you know. And I was like, whoa. And then when Matt met him, because Bill Murray, because he had been to SNL a couple of times, so I went over and felt very comfortable going over and going, hey, man, how are you? He goes, hey, yeah, I'm doing this thing, and yeah, it should be fun. And I'm talking to him, and Matt Stone was like, all right, because I presented them an award, so he came over to me. He's like, hey, man, and he's, you know, you ready to get out of here or whatever, and he sees Bill Murray and goes, holy fuck. He's like, holy shit. He goes, I'm so fucking glad I came here tonight for this. Can I shake your hand, dude?
Oh, shit.
Holy shit. Like, he was the most starstruck I had ever seen that, ever. He was just like, holy fuck, you're Bill Murray. Bill ghost-busting ass Murray. Yeah. It's like, he just freaked out. And I was like, yeah, he does that to people. And I get, here's the last funny Bill Murray story was, he did a bit, when we did these Thursday night specials, and he did a bit in it. And when we were rehearsing, and the whole cast was in it, and everyone was kind of, whether you knew it or not, everyone was kind of on, because there's like Bill Murray's up there, and he's like the coolest. He's like a jazz musician or something, just kind of sitting there real chill, and everyone's kind of like looking up at him, you know, and doing like bits very loudly to each other. Everyone's kind of like, okay, and then kind of like, chill out, okay, but you know, it's Bill Murray, you know. And so then at the after party, he started talking to me, and we were having a great conversation, and we started talking about baseball and basketball and, you know, things like that. And I very infrequently will get a migraine headache where you can't see anything, where you get like aura. And as I'm talking to him, for the first time since, you know, like in 2 years, that is when God decided to give me a migraine. Where he was like, Bill, come sit with me. Let's talk. And I was like, cool. I got to go because I can't see anything. Oh, and I was like, and I was in the cab like, why is this happening?
That should be a commercial for a migraine medicine.
Yeah. If you meet Bill Murray. Yeah, the guy like, are you Bill Murray? And he's like, sit down with me and let me tell you all my secrets.
Oh, no. Oh.
I can't see anything.
Yeah. Your face is a round circle of light.
Yeah.
I don't know what I'm looking at anymore.
Because you never know when you're going to meet Bill Murray.
If you meet Bill Murray. This might cause bleeding.
Side effects may include self-flagellation.
Self-flagellation.
In a cab on the way home.
Yeah. Saying you liked him in Dr. Detroit.
Was Bill in Dr. Detroit?
No. It's like Dan Aykroyd.
Yeah. I didn't know if he did a cameo.
He was in Dr. Detroit.
Someone just, I think it was on... maybe Huffington Post or whatever, but it was like 19 pictures that will make you feel like you're in the 80s, and they're fucking awesome, just like candid pictures, like, oh, the wedding photo of Tom Hanks and Rita Wilson, and then just fucking Bill Murray and Dan Aykroyd hanging out in 1985, like just having a beer. Yeah. And it's Venkman era Bill Murray and Stance era, you know, and it just feels like, God damn it. I don't know if I'll did they have any sense at the time of what they were a part of?
Yeah.
Well, at that time, they were two of the biggest comedy stars
in the world.
Yeah. At that moment,
but,
in 85.
Dan Aykroyd got nothing but trouble made. So.
Yeah. That's true.
There's moments.
Nothing but Trouble does have moments.
Yeah.
It is interesting. I just watched that movie recently.
It's a really crazy high concept.
It's so bonkers.
Yeah.
It's so weird.
But I got to tell you, though, with Ghostbusters, if you watch the deleted scenes, it feels like, and I honestly, I have no... I'm basing this on nothing more than just a feeling, which would make it...
a true podcast.
More than a feeling?
Which would make it, you know, adequate for the internet. Yeah. That the deleted scenes, Ivan Reitman cut a lot of the SNL-y kind of stuff out of them, where they're like, there's this one scene where it's Bill Murray and Dan Aykroyd doing these homeless guys walking through Central Park, and they're just like, their characters are up to 11.
Yeah.
And he just like, it just like, he just lifted all that stuff out. And it was almost like he sort of, they had to fight against a little bit of the sort of Second City stuff.
Yeah, kind of ground it in something where you're like, no, you're this. What always happens to those things, and I've been a part of movies like that where when you're shooting it, you're trying a lot of stuff. And then you could tell in the editing, they went, okay, no, wait. Okay, Dan Aykroyd's the nerd guy. Just keep him that, because that scene kind of seems inconsistent. But you know what I mean?
Right.
Yeah.
And it makes sense because they kind of do that in the second one when they're the... the sewage guys.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Oh, you want to come with me? You want to go? You got to go down the top.
And they're talking like that, and you're like, oh, they can do voices and stuff, you know? So that maybe makes sense.
No, you're parapsychologists. You don't do voices.
Yeah. It's just like at the end of, Trading Places, where just everything goes off the rails, and Dan Aykroyd is all of a sudden can do characters and stuff like that to get, you know.
Yeah, he plays the Jamaican guy.
Hey, man.
Yeah. But you grew up in Ivy League school.
Yeah.
But it is interesting that you can be on a set and you do something and it just crushes when you're shooting, and everyone's like, oh my God, well, this is going to be the biggest moment of this thing. And then you see it, and you're like, oh, that didn't...
No, it didn't work at all.
It didn't work
at
all.
And the thing that you don't think is fun, the thing that's kind of like, well, let's see how that goes. Sometimes it is. The thing that people are laughing the hardest at while you're shooting something is the thing that people love.
Well,
you know,
like,
it just depends.
Yeah, it's just like a stand-up bit that you get the idea for and you think is the funniest fucking thing in the world, and then you go do it, and it's like, oh.
No one liked it.
Guess it wasn't that funny.
But I also, the hardest, biggest laugh I got on the set of Superbad was when McLovin runs away, and I said, McLovin, why? Like that. And that, like, in the movie, it doesn't really, you know what I mean? Like, I was like, oh, like, the whole, I was like, man, I can't wait for people to see when I say McLovin, why? Because that made the crew really laugh. And then it played, and people were like, what's going to happen with McLovin? You know?
I mean, if you really wanted to get boring about it and understand the science of, like, comedy dynamics, it's like, oh, the proximity of you to them, to the crew, to being in the situation in this organic moment versus you are basically under a microscope.
Yeah.
and it's not in the same context.
And everything you've seen before it and where it's going and where – and that's the thing that it does matter. Because I remember when I tried to start writing a movie, comedy, that – you know, you always want to just get in all the bits and stuff, but it really is when it works the best is when you're not laughing that much and you're just trying to figure out the emotional through line of the movie, because that's kind of what people – that's why I think, Monty Python is like my – I mean, that's the thing I grew up on loving. And as I got older, I was like, oh, no, Life of Brian's like their best movie. You know what I mean? People might not find it the funniest, but it's by far their best movie.
It's like the one I go back to the most. Yeah. Is Life of Brian. Yeah.
Because it has such a strong story. Mm. You know what I mean? And that's the thing. Like that's like a bit that everyone laughs at. But then if you just plug that, it doesn't really
Romanus eo dominum. Like it was the Latin lesson on the side of the funny. Fucking. Mm. I mean, but it's but I guess it's also. Yeah.
It has sketches in it, though. I mean, that movie has, like, tons of, like, two-person sketches. But it has this kind of ticking clock to it, which I think is so great of, you know, him being crucified and is he going to get out and, like, the satire of it so strong. But it is just a bunch of sketches, but well put it masked.
I feel like you can't – maybe as a comedy person, your instinct is to, like – is you start with the scoop of the jokes first, and you're like, and then we'll figure out the story part underneath. And you're like, no, that's like flash paper.
Yeah, yeah. You kind of what I've learned working at South Park is, you know, if you the inspiration you get, you kind of try to hold on to that. Like, what is the thing that made us laugh? You know, it could have been 3 months ago, but that thing made us laugh. You know, and we're doing one of the first ones I worked on was the Kanye West Gay Fish one where he was gay fish.
I have a 7-inch of that song.
So the gay fish thing was like, no, that made us laugh. And then 3 months later, you know, at a retreat, we came up with this gay fish thing. And then you kind of go, maybe it's not as fun. No. So you try to retain that inspiration. And Trey's really good at that. But then it's like when you're trying to figure out the story, you want it to be just, I don't know, resonant in some way, you know what I mean? And then because you can always be funny, you just want to be confident that we can always make this funny, you know what I mean? But let's make sure the story makes sense, you know? And that's why comedies are just way harder.
Well, it's interesting that you because we never really met before today. I mean, maybe just like briefly.
Didn't you moderate the Paul?
Oh, I did. I did the Paul panel. Yes, I did the Paul. That
but
was
I
right
couldn't hear you at all.
I know. And every panel that I've moderated at Hall H since then, I've always used that as an example of like, you have to aim a speaker at the panel because no one can hear anything.
Yeah, you can't hear a thing. It was so bizarre. We were like, what's
because the audio just disappears into the back of the room.
Yeah, because it's not.
I just did it again, Hall H, and I said that I was like, you know, you can't hear each other up there. It's really weird. And
it's not important.
We can't afford more speakers.
Just get like a $20 speaker from you. Just go to the.
Yeah,
you want you gonna give
us.
Me $25?
Yeah. Oh, sure. I would be happy to give you
$25. It's built for the least sound. It's just a giant room that is designed to have a banquet hall.
It's basically like a driving range. Just like the ball just
disappears.
But so. To me, my experience with you is you're like a pretty laid-back guy, yet you have – maybe you're not. I just don't know you that well. But you essentially had two concurrent jobs that were probably two of the highest pressure jobs and on opposite coasts.
Yeah.
That you had to like, oh, you got 5 days for this show and 6 days for this show and you just got to fucking
– They're both 6 days. Oh, no, I guess it is 5 days. No, six with both. But, yeah, it's hard. It's – I mean, South Park, I don't do a lot of heavy lifting. It's really those guys. You're just helping them out with their idea. The pressure is really on them, you know. I'm just like, I come in at 10, and then it's really amazing. You'll come in at 10 a.m., and then they'll go, okay, so, you know, we have these three scenes in Act 1, these two scenes in Act 2, and we know we want to end with this scene. So how do we get from this scene to this scene? Let's talk about that. And then you'll kind of come up with, you know, three or four different scenes that kind of move the plot along. And then what tends to happen is then you leave at 1 a.m. or 1 p.m., you leave, and the next day you come in at 10 a.m., and everything you talked about is fully animated. It's all done.
Jesus Christ.
They do it. They turn around stuff incredibly fast there.
The hard work is mainly for the animators.
Yeah, the hard work is done. Like, guys, good luck. You know,
those poor guys sleeping on the floor.
They have to wait.
Yeah.
Just waiting around. That documentary is one of the most stressful documentaries I've ever seen.
Oh yeah, but it is just them. I mean, I've never. I think I've been a part of. Yeah, maybe one, where they kind of threw out. I don't know. Maybe it was Sunday. Maybe because the show airs Wednesday. Maybe. I've heard stories where they've thrown out shows as late as, like, Monday, where they go, you know what, this isn't working, scrap all this, we're starting over, you know what
Jesus
I mean?
Jesus Christ.
And they just, like, but I think that's a testament to them wanting the work to be good. I think a lot of times when someone is, when they've done something for that long, what tends to happen, and it makes total sense, is you become incredibly wealthy, you can really feel, and you can now enjoy yourself, and so you become more of, like, a manager. And you go, you guys do this. I know I used to be on the floor, but, you know, directing things. But you guys do this. I'm going to go and enjoy myself because I've killed myself for the last 10 years to get to this place. But they aren't like that. They are so – everything is about the show and the comedy and keeping it, you know. And it's the same thing at SNL. Like, Lorne's still, you know, really involved. And he's on the floor with you and saying – I don't think this works that way. I'm like, I've been doing this for like 40 years, you know?
I couldn't be at a Yankees game with Billy Joel, but I'm here.
Yeah.
Well, I guess it maybe some of it has to do with, you know, what is it that you want? And if that thing is like, well, I just want to get comfortable. And so I'll work really hard for like 10 or 15 years, and then I'll be comfortable, and then everything will be fine. But if it really is about the craft, then I guess that never goes away. But I think that's why so many comedy people just sort of...
Well, South Park amazes me every time.
It's unbelievable the quality has never waned.
And that's
anything's really, gotten better.
Yeah. And that is them just trying to learn. I mean, it really is. They just learn from it, and they go, you know, oh, no, we've made that. You hear that a lot. No, we've done that before. We made that mistake once. You know, no. I don't think that's good. And then... once you get an idea and you go, no, this really works, this is like a funny thing, watching them go, yeah, but it's, I think you'll see it come, you know, it is good and it works, but as I'm watching it, you can kind of see it coming. Yeah. So how do we subvert it in a way where you don't see it coming? And they bang their head against the wall every week to make it work, and that's why it's good.
And every time there's a Randy Marsh episode, I get really
I also think some of it has to do with the fact that it's a small team.
Yeah.
And there's just not enough time to overthink things and overnote things. It's just like, this was really funny right away. Let's just fucking do it.
This
and
is making us
get
laugh.
It done. Yeah.
Like, that writer's room, to me, has always been like, how do we get back to that place you were in high school? Like, the funniest I've ever been in my life was in high school in the lunchroom with my friends. That's, like, the hardest I've ever laughed in my life. I will never be that funny again. Like, you just laughing, and there was no pressure. There was no, like, you know, overthinking it or whatever. It was just totally unfiltered, and you relaxed, and it was a lot of fun. And I feel like the writer's room there is them trying to, you know, kind of harness that, you know? And so it's a lot of – it's a lot of fun, and every day there I leave going, oh, I learned that, you know what I mean? Oh, wow. I'll come back going, I thought we were gonna go this way, but I see now why you guys went that way, and it does work better that way, you know. But they never act like they know what they're doing, which is I think they're so great. You know, it's that what do you call it? I'm going to compare Trey and Matt to Akira Kurosawa real quick.
You know what?
When he got his honorary Oscar, and he was like, you know, the greatest filmmaker of all time, and he got his Oscar in 1990, and he was like 80 years old, and his acceptance speech was like, I'm still trying to figure this shit out. Wow. And it was very genuine. Like, I thank you for giving me this. I still don't know how these things work, but I'm going to figure it out, you know what I mean? And like, I'm going to try to keep figuring it out, you know?
I never saw that.
It's great. It's all, and I don't know. I just think that's, you got to have the attitude of like a student, and those dudes totally, and like Pixar guys too. Like, I was up at Pixar all last week, and they're the same thing. Those guys are just like total just students. They never, like, I'm working with Pete Docter on his new movie, Inside Out, and like, I'm like, you did Up and Monsters Inc. You should be like smoking a cigar.
Yeah, feet up on the table.
He's just like, oh, I don't know, man. I just, you know, they have all the same insecurities everybody has.
You have to stay. I think with particularly comedy, if you want it to last, you always have to. Not to take a line from Eye of the Tiger, but you always have to stay hungry. Like, you always and part of it is with being complacent, being comfortable, is like, you're not hungry anymore.
Yeah.
Not that you shouldn't, you know, like, it doesn't matter if you make a ton of money, or if you make a ton of money, great, but you still have to find something that keeps you really hungry.
Yeah. I remember, reading the line of Bob Odenkirk saying, like, if I wasn't getting paid this, even if I still lived in Illinois, I would be doing this stuff in my house.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, you just do it because you just can't help it. You just want to do this.
Yeah. Another Breaking Bad person, Bryan Cranston, said the same thing on the podcast. He was
really?
Like, yeah, because that's I was right kind of poking around trying to play the card of, like, I mean, as performers, we're all sort of insecure. And he was like, no, what do you mean? Like, he was like, I would be doing this if I had 5 roommates in a shitty apartment in Brooklyn.
As long as I could keep acting.
As long as I could keep acting. And then you're like, oh, okay, yeah.
Oh, no, it's true, though. It's like, oh, you should go up there and do that. I mean, that's like, you know, and you never know how it's going to go. And when it goes bad, you go, oh, that went bad. I wonder how I learned from that. You know what I mean? Oh, don't do that again. You know what I mean?
You go ahead.
Yeah, I remember, I think it was like your first or second year at SNL, and you and Nick Jesenovic were writing like a horror comedy.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember talking to Nick about where it's like you guys got to get notes back from like Edgar Wright.
Yeah.
And stuff like that, and how you just like, oh, like you were still like, you know, do you feel that like that's like with an old script like that, you would ever go back to it now with all the knowledge you have?
Yeah, I think if you look back at those first drafts, you would go, oh man, it's what I was talking about earlier. There was no story. It was just kind of super modular bits, you know, that could be moved around and put in any order, you know what I mean? And so it was Edgar saying, oh no, Shaun of the Dead, though, it's, you know, you work it out, the emotional beats of it, and like what about this guy's life and about the character, and and it was, we'll make it funny. Just make it. It's almost better to either outline it or just write it straight, because it's so much easier to subvert things and make it funny once you have a straight
thing
works. Like a straight, like a almost like a drama base, you know?
Yeah.
And then you just start breaking it up and messing around with it and see what happens. It kind of, it's fun to build something like that and then just start breaking it apart.
Yeah, I remember what Nick was saying about like the thing they were trying to like that Edgar was telling you guys is like, and also like, you know, write it, but then also write it backwards.
Yeah,
where it's like go back and, you know, put in callbacks and put in stuff.
Yeah, which they do so well.
They do so well. I mean, Shaun of the Dead is just like a perfect movie.
Yeah,
and
it's the same thing where you make it like these kind of like, you know, mouse traps of like different things. This hits this. Oh, that's a callback to that. Mm-hmm. You know. But
at the core of it, you have to say, what does this guy want?
Yeah.
And how can we either keep that from him or force him to
And what's
to
the
get
conflict
it?
Here? What's the, and do you care about what the person wants? And is it, you know, interesting? I mean, there's so much big questions. But if you go into it going, okay, we got to figure out what this guy wants and makes him interesting, you'll go crazy. Then you're just being super, you know, like a surgeon or something. It's too removed. But if you could put your own self into it, or you're just talking with your friends, you're like, oh my gosh, it's about this guy who did, you know, or you're alone in your car thinking about something and then you get inspired. That's what I mean. That's what, you know, those guys like Edgar and people like that, you always feel like it came from this and is an inspiration for something, you know, that you get excited about and you don't think, you don't, you know, analyze it too much. You just go, oh God, what if we were in a zombie apocalypse?
Yeah.
What would we do if we were in a zombie apocalypse?
That's what's so interesting. You know? That's what's so kind of fucked up about the entertainment business is that then you get that excitement and then the rest of the business just tries to smush that down.
Yeah.
As much as like, let's drag this out. Let's let the lawyers talk about this for a year before you're even allowed to make this thing.
Yeah.
Now let's give it notes. Now, and then you're all of a sudden the character in the thing where you're like, I just want that thing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's why I was in, I mean, for my wife's movie, you know, it's like she wrote it and essentially everyone in town, you know, all the big studios were like, we don't want to do this. And then she just kind of was like, well, we'll just figure out a way to make it, you know? And I've been working on a lot of movies like that where you got to keep it moving. It's like you're trying to get someplace and the freeway is all jammed up. So you're like, just to keep moving, it takes me longer.
But you just
but I just don't want to sit there. I'm going to go all the way over here. I'm going to get there. But as long as I keep moving instead of just, you know, slowly inching your way to your goal. You know, I've worked on 3 films now, that are just $1 million films, you know, and all of them have the kind of like that similar story. Is I made it and everyone said no. So I just was like, if I have to go find a good camera, I'll edit it on my laptop. I have you here. we'll pull in another friend. Yeah. You know, you're going to be wearing your own clothes. We'll be shooting at my apartment, my friend's apartment. You know, we'll just figure out a way to do this. That's the nice thing now is you don't need to ask for permission to make your thing. And that's what I was impressed with. My wife, Maggie, and Craig Johnson did this movie, Skeleton Twins. And this guy, Ned Benson, did this movie, The Disappearance of Eleanor Rigby. I was just impressed with that, the determination just to like, go, well, no, I'm just going to make it. I'm not going to wait and listen to all these people. I'm just going to make it, you know? And then you guys, it's out of my hands. But right. Let me at least make it and make all my own mistakes and make something I like or just go, I can stand by this instead of it going through this other kind of going through this machine, and then I'm like, well, I don't know what it is anymore.
Well, yeah, exactly, because you run the risk of trying to put it through the machine of, well, it may never happen, but even if it does happen, I might lose it anyway.
Yeah.
So I might as well just make the thing that
just
I
make
want.
Make the thing you want to make, and, you know, that's what Maggie said. She's like, I don't need anybody to tell me what's wrong with my movie. I fully know what's wrong with my movie because I lived through it, and I learned through, you know, I learned by doing it and by editing it, going, oh man, this thing does not work. I gotta cut. Well, geez, that's a big blemish. But I love all this other stuff. I love this. But you feel better about it and own it, and you learn more instead of, why do they make me do this?
Yeah,
and it so doesn't work. And now it's not their name up on the poster; it's my name on the poster, and my name saying directed on it, and it looks like this is my taste, and it's not my taste.
You can't ever go, but they gave me these notes. Yeah, they're like, you can't, sure, it was them.
Yeah, yeah. You can't have a big, open the movie like, hello, what you're about to see is not my movie. I wish it was my movie.
I'm going to do a PowerPoint presentation of all the emails I received from the studio while making this movie, so everyone
here's what
can
happened.
See that's not.
But then you hope what happens. I don't know if this happens anymore, but at least, you know, 10, 15 years ago, you know, when guys like Paul Thomas Anderson and Wes Anderson and people like that, was they did their own little movie, and then it would come out, and then people would say, you know, a studio or something, we love this, we want to pay you to do what you do because we love this.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And I don't know how much that happens anymore. You know, Jodie Hill kind of had it.
It's happening on cable television now.
100%.
That's where it's happening. Like, independent movies have turned into cable.
On Netflix.
And on Netflix.
Yeah, I mean, it's not even... It used to be a thing now where people would go, the movie's opening on demand and in theaters on the same day or whatever, and it's a bummer. And I'm like, I think that's... I just watched Mud the other day. The movie's great.
Yeah, I have that queued up.
That was great. And it was on, like, I didn't see it in the theater. I saw it on video on demand. I know, but I don't know if that's bad or not, but I still saw it and I loved it. And I'm telling people, like, you should go see this. It's really great.
Yeah, I pay-per-viewed Drinking Buddies.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, which is Swansburg,
a
new movie. And, you know, it's just, like, I figured, like, watching it like that, it still gets the numbers instead of me having to drive down to, you know, Santa Monica to go see it in, like, a small art house.
I'm just saying there's more ways to see these things now. Yeah. It's just going to be different. Everyone's kind of used to, like, the model of seeing things, things working a certain way, and it's just different now.
I think someone said that, and I apologize if this is wrong information, but what I heard was that Spielberg basically has this theory that going to see a movie will be like going to see a theater.
Yeah.
That at some point it'll just, you'll pay $50 for a ticket and it'll be this fucking epic. Like, it has to be at a certain level.
Yeah, and they're bringing food, I think, is another, like, the dining thing is going to be a bigger thing
in the future.
You're going to see more and more, like, and to your point, like, come in, have food, take in a movie. Because,
well, draft houses are expanding. They're opening up one downtown. There's more opening up around the country where you can get food and drinks and watch a movie.
Just making it like you're not just going to go and sit in the theater with your, you know, Coke and popcorn and watch a movie.
Well, there has to be one, because it's very difficult now, especially now, to get people to get out of their fucking house.
Yeah.
So you have to give them one special element of like, well, but I guess if we have this, the experience just used to be, look what they did. They made all those images move and they put it up on a thing. And now it's like, that's not enough of an experience anymore.
Yeah. No, it's true. And it's like the cable television thing. That's why you watch cable TV.
I miss
TV.
The simpler times, you guys. And people would duck out of the way of the train coming towards them.
Yep. Not anymore.
I like, though, I mean, it is true. People are saying it, but it's totally true that it's like a golden age of TV right
oh,
now.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And when I was on SNL, I was so inundated with pop culture because we were writing stuff. When I would go home, I was like, only watch Criterion DVDs. And I, you know, and really, you know, depressing documentaries about like Jonestown or something like that. I was like, I don't want to pay attention to any of this stuff.
That's exactly.
And then when I was off the show, that's when I was like, oh, is Game of Thrones good? Yeah. You know, I should watch it. And I'm like, this is great. Why didn't I help write that thing we did on? Yeah. You know what I mean?
I was doing the same thing when I was at the Soup. I was so inundated with all the just pop culture shit that like I can't watch any more reality shows. I'm just going to take a break. My break would be watching I remember one time I was just listening to the tape at Jonestown. When he was like passing it, when they were passing
out
the
food. Oh, yeah, yeah.
I was
yeah.
just listening to what he was saying for like 2 hours.
It's so bonkers.
Wow. Yeah, yeah. Just because I wanted the complete opposite side of the spectrum.
Yeah, you want the most depressing. I mean, that's why I started doing Keith Morrison, the Dateline stuff, because I would watch those Dateline shows because it's super depressing and fucked up. And I was like, oh, we would never do anything like this. I need balance in my brain for some reason. Too much joy at work. I need sadness. Yeah. I'm now it's like I've been going crazy watching like the original Killing and
yeah that's
just started Justified.
Justified's
fun. I haven't watched it.
Justified's really it's fun.
Is Bates Motel good?
I haven't seen Bates Motel.
It's no Ray Donovan, but it's pretty good.
Yeah,
nothing is
Ray Donovan.
Nothing is Ray Donovan.
R.I.P. Bridget.
So as we're sort of wrapping this up, did you just fucking hashtag? Was that a hashtag?
Hashtag no. God save Bunchy.
Yeah.
God damn it. I don't know what any of that means.
A bunch of like three cars in L.A. just went.
God damn it.
One of them's Liev Schreiber. Yeah. What the fuck did he say?
Just know that from now on, for the next 3 months, there's an implied Ray Donovan spoiler alert.
Oh, way to go.
Every podcast.
Now that you find out that Bridget dies, like it's a sister that died 15 years ago, Chris. It's time to get over it.
I can't get over it. It's a thing. That I listen, that show should follow my viewing habits, and the rest of society should protect me for being busy. What are you gonna now that you're in Los Angeles? Is there what do you want to do, or what are you working on, or what's
I'm writing stuff, and then I'm working at South Park for this season, which is just the next 3 months or so, and then I'll just see, you know, I kind of am just writing right now, it's still like in that place of just figuring all this shit out.
Animals from the Future reunion?
No, I don't think. No, because Matt Offerman moved to Illinois.
What?
Yeah.
When?
Geez, like a year ago.
Oh, really? Yeah. Shit.
So that's not going
to
happen.
I would like to thank you and also apologize at the same time, is that you were supposed to be on Talking Bad the other night, and then Aaron Paul's schedule moved.
It's okay to get bumped for Aaron Paul.
Well, it was actually, I actually, when I found out that, because it happened late in the week, and I said, you should see if Bill can move to later, because it was more to protect you.
Yeah.
Because, you know, especially what can happen on a show like that is that if there's someone who's not on the show and then a couple of people who are on the show, then all the fans are like, who's that other guy? Why is he? I want to hear what Jesse has to say. And I just didn't want to put you in that situation.
No, not at all.
And
I totally
so
got it.
I was like, see if there's any way that he can move later in the schedule so it's not right there, and you very graciously did. So I'm very glad.
Oh, no problem. I'm excited to do that show. I'm excited and nervous to do that show.
Oh, it'll be fun. It'll be fun.
That last episode was so good.
Yeah,
I just can't. I haven't seen ahead. I can't even. You know, like it just they've already started at such a crazy place. I'm like, how?
I know. That's why I love that show. There's no because watching these other TV shows, kind of catch them on TV shows, and then watching Breaking Bad, it is really interesting because you see how different and how kind of crazy the narrative propulsion of that show, yeah. how linear it is, how there's no fat on it. There's never a scene. There's never like multiple subplots going where you're like, oh, now we're following this guy and this person. Everything's kind of headed the same direction, but I feel like it's been that way since the beginning. It's one of the only shows where I watch it and every show I'm constantly reminded like, oh, this is because he made that decision in the first episode,
right? Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Because he made this is another, it's just this long domino effect.
I sometimes I think about it as sort of the dramatic, that the philosophical dramatic counterpart to Arrested Development, where it's like something that you really didn't even think twice about way before is like, oh, now this is the thing, and this has consequences that are going to pay off.
Like Leaves of Grass or whatever.
Yeah. Yes!
You go, Leaves of Grass, well, that's a funny, weird thing, and then it's like, oh my gosh.
Well, also, it's what I think is kind of amazing about it is that a lot of series, when they're ending, is you get the sense that it's just like the last five or six episodes are like kind of filler, and then the last episode is where they're like, now here's all the shit that's gonna go down.
Yeah.
But this one is just like, oh no, there's a whole,
you just, it's building to this thing that you really want them, I just want them to stick the landing, you know, you want them to, like, it's so good that you just don't want it to be, because there's that one moment a couple of seasons where the thing with Jesse and the girl, you know, like, or the kid getting poisoned,
Brock,
and all that stuff. That was like, I was like, this is getting a little dicey.
Yeah.
But it's like a little, like, wait a minute, how would he, you know what I mean? Yeah. It was the first time I ever felt that way in the show, but then it kind of rebounded in that, in the next episode.
Yeah. Right.
And so, it's so funny that any other show, I would forgive things, but with Breaking Bad, it's like the bar has been set so high that you're almost like, don't, you know.
Yeah. Vince was very, like, he seems very much like, we're really happy with the way that it ended, and we think everyone's going to be satisfied, and we're satisfied.
I think that's why it's good. It seems like people writing shit for themselves.
Yeah.
It really does.
Yeah.
They're like, we want to see this. And so, I'm probably going to be on board no matter what happens.
Yeah.
Well, we'll see you in a couple of weeks on the show. And is there anything you want to plug or promote or anything?
I'm in Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs 2.
Hey!
Sweet.
And that comes out late September.
More meatballs.
More meatballs. They become sentient.
Oh, no.
Yes.
Like Meatwad?
Yes. No.
I play this one clip from Aqua Teen Hunger Force over and over again where he just goes, you ain't gonna give me that sippy cup, and then he spills it, and it just fucking unhinges me every single time I watch.
I was on that show twice and I never saw my episode.
Oh, you didn't?
No, I never got a chance to see him.
Oh.
I miss them. I should go find them.
To the internet!
Yes.
It's good to see you, man.
Yeah,
thanks
nice,
for coming
thank you.
And hanging
oh,
out.
Anytime, man. This was awesome.
Cool.
Thank you. All right.
Enjoy a burrito, everyone. Actually, we're literally about to enjoy our burritos. Kyle brought us food.
Okay.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
For more than two centuries, the White House has been the stage for some of the most dramatic scenes in American history. Inspired by the hit podcast American History Tellers, Wondery and William Morrow present the new book, The Hidden History of the White House. Each chapter will bring you inside the fierce power struggles, the world-altering decisions, and shocking scandals that have shaped our nation. You'll be there when the very foundations of the White House are laid in 1792, and you'll watch as the British burn it down in 1814. Then you'll hear the intimate conversations between FDR and Winston Churchill as they make plans to defeat Nazi forces in 1941. And you'll be in the Situation Room when President Barack Obama approves the raid to bring down the most infamous terrorist in American history. Pre-order The Hidden History of the White House now in hardcover or digital editions wherever you get your books.